Last year, on the Day of the Dead, I was trudging alone through a desert of grief, and I felt parched. My sister Louise had died 124 days before then, after living well with colon cancer, stage 4, for nearly 10 years. A friend had shared the metaphor of grief as a desert you know you will get through to get to the land of your new normal, but still you have to trudge through one step at a time. At that point, I was walking out of the world, but I always felt out of step. I was impatient with myself. I was envious of my family who seemed further along in their desert trudges than me. I felt stuck. My mood could best be described indelicately as pissy. In the past, Louise was the person who would cajole the pissy out of me, so I knew I needed to try something else. I followed the Day of the Dead rituals the way Allison had taught me, Allison being our religious education director. I didn't know on that Day of the Dead what I really was looking for was a new metaphor. I'm here today to share that metaphor, the story how I've got it, and what it's meant to me since then. By now, you've likely surmised that my metaphor is my epigenetic inheritance. Now that I've revealed it, let me define it. Scientifically, but simplistically speaking, epigenetics are the things that turn off and on the genes in our DNA, be they the food we eat, the environment we live in, or the stress and trauma we experience. The burgeoning study of epigenetic inheritance looks at how epigenetic cues or tags are transferred from generation to generation to generation. The most widely reported study of this found that genetic changes stemming from trauma suffered by Holocaust survivors had been transferred to the DNA of their children and grandchildren. To be clear, my definition of epigenetic inheritance is more metaphoric than it is scientific, with a little bit of genealogy thrown in. My hope is that by sharing it, I can help those of you on your own walks with grief, or help inspire others to consider how your own epigenetic inheritance may help chart your walks through life. Back to my metaphor's origin story on the Day of the Dead. After I created an altar for my sister in my kitchen, I followed her favorite yoga class online, all the while thinking, I breathe in and I breathe out for the two of us today. I lay down in Shavasana, the final resting pose. The cool tile floor felt all the more welcoming because of the heat of the day and the way the day felt pregnant with the possibility of a message from the other side, from her. My stillness was uninterrupted by the phone, which I let go to voicemail. If it's a Daryl Issa robocall, I thought, I am really going to be ripped. Instead, I heard, hello, this is Dr. Eric Corshane. I shot up to answer the phone. Eric Corshane is perhaps the most famous autism researcher here in San Diego. He's known to me through my son, Xander, who is autistic. Dr. Corshane told me that the blood sample that Xander had given a long time ago as part of an autism study showed, he said, really important gene variation. His lab would like to get another sample, extract stem cells from it, and grow a neural network to learn more. Now that was the kind of message that could be sent from the other side by my sister. She had willed her body to her oncologist for study. And when I imagined growing a neural network, it looked like watercolor paint spreading out like possibility, like branches. Branches like those on the trees of the paintings she did to manage the psychological side of cancer. Branches like those on the painting of hers on your order of service. That day led me down a rabbit hole of Googling about genetics that led me to the researcher's concept of epigenetic inheritance and the Holocaust study. It also led me to these questions. What if it's not just the experiences of trauma and stress that can be passed on genetically? What if my genetic code contains traits of my ancestors beyond my poor eyesight? What if strands of their moral code are woven into my genetic code? I began to think about my moral epigenetic inheritance, about which ancestors and which values are part of me, and how those values influence the way I act. And last, what values I share with my sister and how they might be the wellspring I needed right at that moment. I confess that my metaphor of my epigenetic inheritance is not entirely logical. It's a bit of a stretch scientifically. I showed a draft of this sermon to Diane Masser-Frye, one of UUFSD's leaders and an actual genetic counselor. She asked the question I'd been asking myself, whether inheriting morals and characters from our family needs to be compared to epigenetic inheritance. She wrote, "We didn't used to think that epigenetic modifiers were transmitted through generations, but it seems indeed they are. We don't understand a lot about that yet." She compared genes to a recipe, like the recipe for your grandmother's apple pie. "Epigenetics," she wrote, "are that special something that isn't written in as part of the recipe, but still important. It's why, when you try and follow your grandmother's recipe, the pie doesn't turn out exactly the same as hers did." I realized in my email exchanges that it's the mystery of epigenetic inheritance that makes the metaphor work for me. I took the idea of that special something and I co-opted it to fit my needs. I didn't need to make the comparison. I wanted to make the comparison. As I thought about my epigenetic inheritance, I settled on the legacy of the strong women before me, mainly my mother, my sister, and the suffragette I'm named for, Sophie Carr Stanton. She was my grandmother's cousin. Since it's my concept of my epigenetic inheritance, I decided to reject the more famous members of my family, most of them military men, including Sophie's grandfather, Edwin M. Stanton, who is Lincoln's Secretary of War. Up until Sophie Carr Stanton, the main job of the women in my family was to marry well. Sophie Carr Stanton never married. She traveled the world as a secretary to diplomats' wives. She explored mysticism and was said to have psychic powers. She followed her own path. And she marched for women's rights to vote. According to my mother, she was arrested at the British Embassy during a suffrage protest. According to the Associated Press, thanks to her famous grandfather, she gave evidence to Congress about indifference on the part of police at the Women's Suffrage Procession of 1913, the first suffrage parade on Washington and the first large political protest on Washington. She was not a leader of the movement. She's not mentioned in history books beyond the one sentence in the AP. She wasn't one to lead the march, but she showed up. Most of what I know about her, I learned from my mother. My mom told me about her when she took me to vote when I was in grade school. I remember helping her pull down the lever of the voting machine with a satisfying clunk. Proud that the Sophie I was named for had made that vote possible. Her legacy to me includes showing up to vote, to march, and to advocate for equal rights. In my case, it's equal rights for the people like my son, who are often marginalized and forgotten. My mom, Marion Hall Chaffee, was the first woman in our family to go to college, even though my grandfather called it a colossal waste of time and money. She studied history and politics. She served in local politics in my hometown in Connecticut and advocated for reproductive rights, fighting against the Comstock Law, which the Supreme Court overturned in the landmark Griswold decision about access to contraception. She died in 2001. I carry her legacy in my advocacy for disabled students, especially my current quest to make sure students with intellectual disabilities learn about sex ed. I heard her voice as I told school officials that it's appalling that at age 17, Xander has never had a sex ed class. All the more appalling given that he's 7 times as likely as his peers to be sexually abused because of his intellectual disability. I'm happy to report that at last, the school is listening and Xander will have his first sex ed class this year. Fresh out of college, my mom worked at the Harvard Business School, where her boss told her, "You could have a future here, but you couldn't have a family." That legacy, that the weight of that choice is a legacy to me and as it was to my sister. As my son's main caregiver, it's hard to have much of a career. But my sister urged me to go back to freelance writing, however part-time. "Mom would want you to," she said. My sister took a break from her career as a public school teacher in New York to raise her kids, but went back to teaching when her kids were in school. As a high school world history teacher, often dressed in period garb, she inspired students to think for themselves. On my last visit to her, she asked me to write her obituary. She told me that her favorite lesson involved the book burning of 1492 in Granada, Spain. She told me, "I'd have the kids make lovely replicas of the Jewish, Arab, and three free thinkers' books and take them into the middle of campus. And I, dressed as Queen Isabella, of course, and with the help of the science department, would light them up. The first year was the best. We almost burned down the school." Cancer cut short her high school teaching career, but she continued teaching, mainly narrative writing to fellow cancer survivors. What cancer taught her, she passed on to me. Minimize worry to an allotted time and then move on. Some things are simply out of your control. And most of all, to be grateful for the small things. Every cup of tea, every splash of paint, every breath. That is how you wring every drop of good out of the days you are given. Her legacy to me, the epigenetic inheritance we share, is gratitude and resilience. I connect to her now by playing the gratitude game, often when I'm alone in my car. I tell her my complaints and then think of at least 5 things to be grateful for. Other drivers might think that I'm chatting away on my hands-free cellular device when in fact I am leaning back to her and my ancestors. The way my moral epigenetic inheritance helps me most is knowing that I no longer travel alone. I contain multitudes. For a long time, whenever I was having a bad day, I'd say to myself, "Keep going, keep trying, don't give up." I find that mantra morphing into, "Don't give up. We helped make you strong. We need you to keep this going." These inward travels have helped me connect outwardly as well. Surviving the year first without her has given me strength to reconnect to the outward world as well and to rejoin the human chorus. Also, appreciation for those who loved me with patience when I needed to trot alone and compassion when I needed to sob or talk or just remember, especially my husband, Jim, my daughter, Audrey, and my friends, Chantal and Rachel. I hear now in the human chorus voices like my own, tentative, a tad off key, but growing hearty with the song. When we sing our last hymn together, you might think about what ancestors sing with you. You might hear in the voices near you the song of their ancestors as well. Among the poems my sister sent me from her narrative writing class is John Fox's When Someone Deeply Listens to You. These lines especially get to me. I hear in them Louise beckoning me to open my soul to those here who would love to listen. When someone deeply listens to you, the room where you stay starts a new life, and the place where you wrote your first poem begins to glow in your mind's eye. It is as if gold has been discovered. When someone deeply listens to you, your bare feet are on the earth, and a beloved land that seemed distant is now at home within you. Around the time that Louise invited hospice into her home, she emailed me, "I will always be in your heart and in your brain." To her today, I say, "You are also in my genes, and I find great strength and comfort there." Thank you.